Hello, this is Jay Stowe. I'm going to be picking up where I left off, reading from the Esquire Super Retro Special Issue, their summer issue. I'd started last week reading The Secret Oral History, about a number of contemporary writers, Donna Tartt, Bret Easton Ellis, Jonathan Lethem, and other people who all attended Bennington College in the early 1980s. So we'll pick up where we left off. Jonathan Lethem. Bret's roommate, Miles, was the son of a famous gallerist, Richard Bellamy. They didn't get along. The room was divided in half by a line of broken bottles, a Berlin wall of broken glass. Amy Herskovitz. Two less likely people to live together you can't imagine. God, Miles was such a hippie. There was something transfixing about Bret's space. He would cut out newspaper stories about plane crashes. They papered his wall along with interview magazine covers. Miles Bellamy, class of 1986, did not complete degree, writer, bookseller. A month or two went by, and Bret and I realized that it would be best if he didn't go on my side and I didn't go on his. Occasionally someone would shed blood on the glass, but not often. Bret Easton Ellis. I think about this a lot because of Me Too. I was hanging out with a guy named Karin, nice-looking guy, didn't know him that well, at a fling into spring party. A lot of the parties were mixed with teachers and students because teachers were fucking students, students were fucking teachers. It was just something that happened. Stephen Sandy came on to me and Karin, saying his wife was away and that we should go back to his place and have a threesome. Karin and I were laughing. Karin said, "Let's get out of here." I said, "Yeah, maybe we can find some drugs. Let's go do that." Nicholas Del Banco, Language and Literature Faculty, 1966 to 85. Back then, God help us, it was a badge of dishonor not to have slept with your professor. Jonathan Lethem. When I got to Bennington, I had a starry-eyed feeling. People were developing in such eccentric ways, and so many professors were encouraging that so strongly. It almost felt like a finishing school for people who wanted to forge an identity so that after graduation, they could move to New York and knock the world dead in some artistic venue or other. Brixton was a perfect example of this. She came to school, Laura Salinger, and renamed herself after a Clash song, The Guns of Brixton. Only she didn't want to wait to graduate before becoming famous. Morris Spiegel. The students at Bennington weren't driven by grades, but there was a weird rigor. You had this feeling that life was performance art, that everybody was living in his or her fantasy. I'm trying to find language to describe the electricity that was there, the decadence, the feeling of mystery and enchantment in this ridiculously pastoral setting. Jonathan Lethem. There was the sense that people were playing dress-up, faking it until it became real. I saw the classics click, crossing commons dressed up like they were at Oxford, and I thought, oh, that's what you're making yourself into. Matt Jacobson. When city folk are transplanted into the woods of Vermont, they get slap-happy. Only then do three guys in their daddy's rumpled sports coats appear to be Oxonians. In the fall of 1982, the Greek class consisted of me, Paul McGlowan, and Todd O'Neill. Bret Easton Ellis. Donna and I were set up on a blind date that fall by our roommates, who hated us and thought we were uptight enough to hang out with each other. So we'd have something to talk about, I put in her mailbox a couple of stories I'd written that Less Than Zero would be based on. And she put in mine a story that wasn't The Secret History, but was something in that vein. There was no murder, but it was the world of The Secret History, that milieu, those characters, Claude Fredericks and his classic students. Nicholas Del Banco. A strange fellow, Claude Fredericks. He dropped out of Harvard because he refused to take the swim test or something like that, but he was a genuinely learned person, an autodidact. Knew Latin, Greek, Japanese, punctilious in his self-presentation, and he had an avant-garde printing press, quite famous at the time, called Banyan Press. It published people like Gertrude Stein and the poet Jimmy Merrill, who'd been Claude's lover early on. Morris Spiegel. Claude was my advisor when I was a student at Bennington. I had an appointment with him, and I was waiting outside his office. The door opened, and out stepped this beautiful young man with curly blonde hair. And the first thing I heard Claude say was, not do only what is necessary. Only do what is necessary. And I just thought, what is going on? As my advisor, he had to write these little comments to me, and he said I was a very intelligent girl. I remember that the word intelligent somehow had this negative quality coming from him, from it. Todd O'Neill, class of 83, did not complete degree, classicist, poet. Claude wrote poetry, plays, but his great work of literature was the journals. Bob Giroux at Ferris Strauss said, and this was in the early 60s, "Just bring me your journals, I'll publish them." Then Claude got cold feet because he spoke very candidly about everybody. Years later, he went back, and Bob said, "The moment's passed. Now who knows who Carl van Vechten is?" These journals were gloriously written, and the next step beyond Proust. Aviva Bauer, class of 1987, faculty developer. Here's this single, basically closeted gay man who wrote poetry, yet hadn't been recognized the way his Bennington colleagues like Bernard Malamud and Stephen Sandy had. And he's secretive, and he feels things deeply. He created and occupied this very romantic world, and I think he wanted to find students who could live in that world with him. Todd O'Neill. When I went to interview with Claude, his first question was, "Have you ever had a job?" I said, "No." And he said, "Good." And then he said, "Have you ever been to a football game?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Good." Morris Spiegel. Claude certainly had a male following. My understanding was that his classes were about being homosexual and how to do it with grandeur and history and beauty. Paula Powers. All I knew about Claude Fredericks was that he was having an affair with his student, this good-looking older guy, very serious, very passionate about classics. Todd O'Neill. Donna was not part of our Greek tutorials. The courses she took with Claude, anyone who signed up could take. Claude adored certain women, but he was also homosexual and had a very, let's say, classical aesthetic or hierarchy, which prizes maleness and male beauty. So Donna only knew him in a limited way. She did, however, know Paul McGlone, because they were lovers. Now, Paul was a bit eccentric, not a bad thing at Bennington, a virtue, in fact. He wasn't precisely a scholar, but he was drawn to a scholarly way of life, and Claude embodied for him an image of what college should be. Balliol, or All Souls, in 1843. Paul often used Victorianisms when he spoke or wrote. I remember when he first mentioned Donna. He said, "Who was that charming southern girl in the Homer class?" And Claude said, "You mean Donna Tartt? She's the only Tartt I have with three T's." Matt Jacobson. Donna started wearing those mannish cut blazers. She looked like a mini-me when she was hanging out with us. Todd O'Neill. Paul and Donna weren't boyfriend and girlfriend. They were boyfriend and boy. She had a uniform. Black loafers, khaki pants. Boys' pants, not girls'. J. Press type button-down, necktie, blue blazer with brass buttons, and hair in this funky little asexual bob. She looked like she came straight out of an English university. She and Paul were like Oxonian homosexuals or something. I once asked him, "What kind of relationship do you have?" And he said, "Well, that's very funny, because she wants to call me her my lad." Oh, sorry, because she wants me to call her my lad. Donna Tartt. Letter to Jonathan Lethem, dated January 24, 1983, during winter break. "I am now in Washington with the man, Paul McGlone. We have a nice little apartment in an old townhouse near Capitol Hill, and all is well. The raciest thing that's happened to us was when we overheard a museum guard in the National Gallery mutter, 'More faggots,' as he walked into the room. I was wearing a baggy sweater and trousers, no makeup, and my customary shapeless gray tweed coat. Perhaps I did look like a boy. It pleased Paul no end." Matt Jacobson. What was strange about Donna was that she was a Miss Budinsky with our group. We all had girlfriends, and the girlfriends were like, "Well, that's his world, and I'm not going to be part of that." Normal in most relationships, but she made it clear she wanted in. Todd O'Neill. Matt didn't like Donna. I liked her to the degree that I knew her, but I found her evasive. A bit impenetrable. And, of course, Matt and Paul and I were all seniors. The truth is, I didn't think too deeply about her until her book came out years later. Jonathan Lethem. My disenchantment with Bennington was fast. All my life, I'd existed in a sort of bohemian bubble. I had the insane idea that I was privileged because I went to repertory cinema. That my parents were lower middle class never registered. And then, all of a sudden, I was at school with the Shah of Iran's daughter. So for me, Bennington was this violent confrontation with the realities of money and class. Yet at the same time, Bennington was a playground I was allowed to play in. The experience was bewildering. Bret Easton Ellis. I got to know Jonathan because my friend Larry David had a crush on him. The first time we met, we were talking about Robert Altman movies. I'll never forget the look on his face when I discussed the merits of Health, A Perfect Couple, Quintet, whatever, because he'd been so breezily confident of his Robert Altman knowledge, and I knew so much more. Jonathan Lethem. It was like an adult talking to a child. I was like, Robert Altman's cool. What I meant was that I'd seen Nashville. Brett had opinions on Altman's whole oeuvre. He gave me a good pocket guide to 70s Altman, and it was just off the top of his head. Winter Break. Lisa Fetter. Bennington had something called NRT, non-resident term. The school couldn't afford to heat itself during the winter, and so it shut down. You went out into the world and got an internship or job. I spent my freshman NRT at the switchboard at the Union Square Barnes & Noble. That's where all the Bennington punk rockers worked. Bret Easton Ellis, Letter to Joe McGinnis, January 1983. If I do not get a job over NRT, I am going to go ahead with an independent work-study project, which will take the form of a novel, tentatively titled Less Than Zero. A bleak, self-absorbed title, if there ever was one. Mark Norris. The only time Bret and I really hung out was in L.A. over that winter break, when Less Than Zero was set. He invited me to a party his high school girlfriend had. It was horrible. It was at a mansion in Beverly Hills, and there were black waiters and kids getting drunk while their parents sipped cocktails by the pool. Brixton and I had broken up before I left Bennington because I was sure she was seeing another guy. That's when she told me she'd had an abortion. She didn't even tell me she was pregnant. Just said something like, I killed your child. Bret Easton Ellis, from Less Than Zero. Daniel also thinks that Vanden, a girl he saw at school, is pregnant. He got this letter from her a couple days ago, and he tells me that Vanden might not be coming back, that she might be starting a punk rock group in New York called The Spider's Web, that it might or might not be Daniel's kid. He says that the letter wasn't too clear. Brixton Smith Start. I left school in December. There were rumors about me being pregnant, which I was, with Mark Norris's baby. It could have been one or two others, but I'm pretty sure it was Mark's. Anyway, I knew music was my destiny, and I was ready to do it for real. Ian Gittler. Brixton asked me to give her bass lessons. A week later, she'd learned her lesson and written 11 songs. 3 months later, she dropped out of college, married Mark E. Smith, lead singer and songwriter of The Fall, and joined his band. Soon after that, Robert Palmer was writing her up in the Times. Bret Easton Ellis. My dad was an angry, abusive person. It seemed so incongruous, the scary family drama in the midst of this beautiful Southern California setting. Then I discovered Joan Didion, and I was getting so many of my cues from her. Less Than Zero started out very journalistic, almost like diary entries. It was about experiencing L.A. as an adolescent in the early 80s. There was a pessimism in the city at the time, the aftermath of Watergate, Vietnam, but an exciting pessimism. This idea of numbness, of looking at things in a flat, neutral, almost banal way, seemed to be the stance people were taking. I didn't know where it was leading, but it was with me when I was writing Less Than Zero in the winter of 83. Spring semester, 1983. Jonathan Lethem. I continued to take art courses, but I was running back to my room to write. I didn't declare myself to my teachers or even to my classmates, except a few, like Jill Eisenstadt and Donna. Probably I was intimidated by Bret and buried it around him. But I was investigating the writing that was going on. I went to the readings and the parties. I was like a spy. Bret Easton Ellis. Nick Del Banco was head of the literature department, a Harvard guy, macho, very much a man of letters. Girls loved him. He used to go out with Carly Simon. Nicholas Del Banco. It was clear from the get-go that Bret was special. Jill was also in that class, and she was very good, very smart, and briefly our babysitter. Bret Easton Ellis. That spring, I also took a workshop with Arturo Vivante. Arturo was an Italian, in the New Yorker a lot, lovely, flirted with all the girls. I parodied him in The Rules of Attraction, Ellis's second novel about the lives and loves of students at the very Bennington-like Camden College. Donna handed in a story called Assassins. That was the moment everyone realized, oh, she's the best writer in the workshop. Her stories were so polished, so much better than anything else. It was kind of unfair. Lawrence Larry David, class of 85, writer-editor. There were people in workshop who stood out, Brett and Donna. Jill was also very distinctive. I'm not going to say Brett and Donna weren't trying to find their way, but they were more formed than many of us were. They had a confidence, a sense of voice. Arturo adored Donna. Jonathan Lethem, from Zealot of Notoriety. With Donna, as with others, I passed through a dazzlingly quick intimacy to violent disagreement, then silence. What compels me now is that in each of these cases, the friend was another like myself, a financial aid case there, stranded among the heirs to various American fortunes. I relished sharing Donna's trance-like aura until the star of our friendship suddenly fell. Brett Easton Ellis. Donna seemed like a very private person, and bracketed by etiquette. This wasn't true of the story she was writing in workshop, where there was a real elegance, yet pushing up against boundaries and facades. Another thing I remember about her workshop stories. Back then, you'd type out your story, then Xerox it for the class, and if you couldn't afford to Xerox, you'd mimeograph. Donna mimeographed. Matt Jacobson. Donna had what she called tea parties. You know, college girl salons. Brett Easton Ellis. The tea parties weren't really my style, but I'd go sometimes. She had a cabinet with liquor in it. She was tiny, yet she could drink everyone under the table. I always felt Donna was very contained, very theatrical. It was hard to get a real sense of her. Jonathan Lethem. So the story I told in my novel Fortress of Solitude, where the protagonist accidentally imprisons a college cleaning lady in the bathroom because she's afraid to come out because a drug party has started, that is 100% documentary. The truth can now be told. Yes, I dealt at Bennington once or twice. Why wouldn't you deal at Bennington? When you went to New York, you'd come back with drugs. If you were interested in getting high, then you could either be spending money or collecting money. And besides, there were legends around the school's ability to protect student dealers. 1983-84 school year. Oh, also, there are a series of photos I'll read the captions to. Clockwise from the top left. There's a photo, a black and white one, of writing professor Nicholas Del Banco with a student. In the upper right, another black and white shot of nonfiction professor Joe McGinnis. Below that, a color photo of Jay McInerney and Brett Easton Ellis in New York sometime in the early 1980s. Below that, a small photograph of Jill Eisenstadt. Next to that, a black and white photo of a Bennington Classics Festival, and there are a number of people walking through a hillside field dressed in togas. This is from the late 1960s. Below that, a photo of Classics professor Claude Fredericks. He is wearing a blue denim shirt and looks Hemingway-like with a salt-and-pepper beard. Next to that, a photograph of Matt Jacobson, Todd O'Neill, and Paul McGlowan. Next to that, a photo of Brixton Smith-Start on the left and Lisa Fetter on the right, looking like brand-new college students, freshmen. Next to that, a photograph of Jonathan Lethem giving the commencement address in 2005. Above that, a shot of Donna Tartt in 1993, looking insouciant. And above that, a photograph of the poet Stephen Sandy in black and white. And in the middle of it all, a black and white shot of the writing professor Arturo Vivante. Jonathan Lethem. Bennington was crawling with self-defined hipsters and artists. In so many ways, it was the ideal setting for me, but I couldn't see that. I projected onto the school all the unfair privileges of the art world, rich people buying each other careers and all that. By the end of my freshman year, I was full of surly outsider resentment. I decided to take off the fall semester. Donna Tartt, letter to Willie Morris, dated October 14, 1983. My dear Willie, am currently taking a term from school. I have begun a novel, and that occupies my days and nights pretty well. Brett Easton Ellis. In the fall of 83, I was distracted because I was writing less than zero and living out the rules of attraction. My situation with Phil Holmes was tortured, but not at first. At first, it was wonderful. It was one of those things where you meet someone and you go off together and you don't talk to anybody else for months. Paula Powers. Everyone noticed that Phil and Brett were constantly together, and speculation ran rampant. Phil did seem and claim to be heterosexual, but for a mere friendship, it was so intensive. Amy Herskovitz. Brett and I were inseparable, and he was forever making passes, and I'd do that girl thing where I'd pretend I was passed out. He told everyone we were dating. I don't think we were ever dating, but I'm like, I can be whatever you want me to be. I don't care. Sari Rubinstein. I think it's important to Brett to appear super normal, like he's a regular guy, and then, of course, all these lurid things are going on. He and Amy were a couple, but she's the one who told me, a gay man is no friend to a woman. Brett Easton Ellis. Over NRT, when I put less than zero together, I got cold feet. Everything Joe loved about my stuff, I didn't trust. I did a version of the book that was in the past tense, third person. I presented it to Joe, and he was like, what is this? You've made it so generic. I was hurt a little bit, but not enough to make any difference. I put it back in the present tense, first person, and fat just started melting away. What had been a 400-page book became a concise 200-page book. Joe was extremely relieved and said, I'm now going to send this to Morgan Entrekin, the editor at Simon & Schuster. David Lipsky, class of 87, transferred to Brown sophomore year, writer. Brett came to find me after winter break because I was the second person to get into Nick DelBanco's workshop as a freshman. The first was him. It was thrilling to meet Brett. He was the only person I knew who was my age and loved books and was trying to figure out how to write them. Brett was cool, magnetic, but I looked at him and thought, I like this person, and I am never going to understand this person. Lawrence, Larry, David. You know what was weird about David? He was so normal. He didn't belong at Bennington. David Lipsky. Brett had me meet Donna. He said to her, David's a good reader. You should show him your book. It was The Secret History. Only it was called God of Illusions then. She had about 80 pages written. She was very pale, super shy, clearly cared only about doing this work. I liked her. Brett Easton Ellis. The book was perfectly formed. The writing was perfect. The only note I ever gave Donna was, you have a college-age male protagonist who's not noticing women or men or anything. That's unrealistic. I will never forget her expression. Silent, staring daggers. David Lipsky. Brett wanted to come off doomed and unfocused in the way of Maria in Play It As It Lays, the Joan Didion novel. Yet, however casual he seemed, he was disciplined as a writer. He read and worked like crazy. Once we were talking about fiction, and he said a thing that disturbed me. Look, everything's been tried already. The domestic comedy that you like has been tried. The stream of consciousness novel has been tried. The Pynchon Phantasmagoria has been tried. There's one thing that hasn't been done yet, and that's sensationalism, and that's what I'm going to do. He already understood where the culture was going and what his job was going to be. Brett Easton Ellis. Less Than Zero was accepted by Simon & Schuster in April. I dedicated it to Joe, and I know Nick was a bit peeved. I was standing near the barn, where the faculty offices were, talking to Joe, and we saw Nick's Jaguar, or whatever Nick drove, and Nick spotted me through the windshield and then revved the engine. Teasing, but I could tell he wasn't. Morgan Entrekin, editor. What you did at SNS in those days was circulate the manuscript. Herman Golub was a senior editor, and he wrote on the sheet for Less Than Zero, if there's a market for callow, fragmentary fiction about rich, self-indulgent, coke-sniffing, cock-sucking zombies, then let's buy it. Then he said to me, but if we do, it's time for me to resign. He was kidding about resigning. His opinion about the manuscript, though, that was not ironic. David Lipsky. Brett showed me the book, and I said, if you publish this, 10 years from now you'll be embarrassed. See, I thought Brett would get viewed not as a writer, but as a commentator on the sorry state of things today. That book is from 1985, and I still have students reading it and loving Brett Ellis. Jonathan Lethem. It's impossible to talk about my going to Bennington without talking about the fact that I was dropping out as soon as I arrived. I told myself I was leaving to finish my novel. So part of my dropping out sophomore year was bravery and arrogance. The other part was ego failure. It was complicated for me that Brett was publishing so early. Yes, he represented the Bennington conflation of privilege and fame that I found so problematic. But he was also so accomplished. Here I was just warming up to this process, and he'd blown off the top of the chart. 1984-85 school year. Brett Easton Ellis. Joan Didion's daughter, Quintana, came to Bennington that fall. The student body president was a good friend of mine, and one of the few women I've had sex with, just so you know. She was also the campus coke dealer. She was a Didion fanatic like me. We kidnapped Quintana her first night on campus. We offered her drugs, then sat around and talked. Joan Rivers' daughter was also at Bennington that fall. Melissa Rivers was touring colleges. And a bunch of people came looking for Quintana, thinking she was the other Joan's daughter. My friend and I bombarded her with questions about her mom, and she asked us questions about Bennington. It was all very chatty. Amy Herskovitz. I heard Brett stole Quintana's underwear that night. Brett Easton-Ellis. Amy says I took Quintana's underwear? Yeah, that sounds vaguely familiar. Sidney Cooper, class of 88, artist. I lived in Franklin, same house as Donna. I don't think I ever saw her walking around campus. Her movements were always furtive, secretive. But we had these things called coffee house on Sunday evenings, and she would always be there, dressed impeccably. I think she was already clear about what she was going to do next, with her intelligence, her wit, her gifts. And she knew she was going to marry her boyfriend, Paul McGlowan, or thought she knew she was going to marry him. She was, in a way, positioning herself. Brett Easton Ellis. Less Than Zero came out at the end of my junior year. There was no money for ads. It was just going to be this little book that did whatever it did. Then the Village Voice ran this giant review by Elliot Fremont Smith. That was the beginning and the ending of something. It was like, oh my God, this could happen. Jay McInerney, writer. Morgan Entrekin gave me a galley of Less Than Zero, and I listened to his spiel about how he was going to promote it as the West Coast version of Bright Lights Big City. Within 6 months of Bright Lights publication, my life was insane. I went from being a grad student to having paparazzi camping on my doorstep. I realized what was happening to me was going to happen to Brett. Nicholas Del Banco. I remember Brett, at the height of his early fame, being driven up by a limo from the Today Show and pouring himself into class with 1 minute to go. It was quite crazy and quite fun. Amy Herskovitz. Did Brett tell you he spent all his money on Cristal? He was so young, he had no idea what to do. Jill Eisenstadt, class of 85, writer. Donna showed an editor of The Atlantic part of her manuscript, and he said, "This'll never get published. You should stop right now." Brett convinced her to show it to Joe. Donna Tartt, letter to Joe McGinnis, dated July 3, 1985. Dear Mr. McGinnis, thank you so much for taking the time to read my novel. I'm very happy you liked it. I am taking a leave of absence from Bennington next fall. I have 7 empty months ahead, and I am going to do nothing but write like a fiend. And that's it for this week's installment from the Esquire special retro, super retro special issue from the summer. I'll pick up next time where I left off, because this is, in fact, quite a long oral history. We have a bit more to go. Have a great week.